Welcome to the Iris Podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Contemporary Issues in Child Protection seminar series organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 9th of May 2011. Richard Wolfson, Young People's Views of the Child Protection System.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to you. As was said, this was a study we conducted when I was in Renfrewshire. And the study is basically a child consultation study. And I know that many of you here are already involved in child consultation and so on. And therefore, I do not wish to be seen as teaching my granny how to suck eggs. So my comments are not intended to be supercilious in any way. But I think we do run into problems when we're consulting with children. Consultation is the buzzword, and we've been obliged to consult with children by law for a long, long time and so on. And everyone consults. But the question is, what does that mean? What are the implications of consulting with children? How do we do it? What are the risks and what are the obligations to us when we consult? And what are you going to do with the results once you get them? It's all very well to line up 100 kids and say, pour your heart out, kids. Tell me everything you feel since you were born. What was your potty training like? Were you happy in nursery? And so on. And they tell you the story, but then what do you do with it? Do you just simply file it away and say, well, we've done a consultation? So I'm going to look at the link between consulting and changing practice. That's very important, because if you don't, you'll find that you will be one of that group of people that children dismiss. And if you read any research, and I've been involved in many studies, I won't go into all that, but where children are asked, what's it like to be consulted? The big thing that comes up is tokenism. They ask me, but they don't do a thing after I tell them. So that's something we'll look at. Anyway, this study in particular was going to be a very straightforward study. It was a breeze. I had been involved for about a decade with my staff, my psychology staff, in conducting various consultations with young people for research purposes. And we had a great publication track record. And we were all practitioners, we're all psychologists working with, like yourself, practitioners with children and young people. So when I was asked by the Child Protection Committee, could we consult with children and so on, we were delighted. It was a straightforward study. We'd have it tied up in a couple of months, report written, all done and dusted. No bother. I think it was 18 months later, as I was bent double, almost broken, with having my staff shed many tears, we finally completed the study, because it was simple yet extremely complex, and I'll explain why. It was a great experience, and we'll kind of take you through it now. Okay, the first thing we did when we started to think about this was that we looked at what's been done. Well, this is obviously what in any program you're doing, you see who's been there before, what have they achieved, what have they done. And generally, you found that there were studies that had looked at children's views of the child protection system, and the children felt their views weren't represented in the child protection system. They felt that they, in general, you could sum it up, The previous research showed that they weren't really able to make their mark. They felt that the child protection system is extremely child unfriendly. Well, that's quite an upsetting thing when we think that we're caring professionals, and yet the recipients think it's not friendly. They're not involved, and kids felt generally powerless. This was the general background of what we were finding about the child protection system. So we decided we'll take a closer look, we'll try and do this properly. And we were working hand in glove with the social work department, with the Child Protection Committee, and with the police and so on. So we had the entire resources of Renfrewshire Council child protection, social work, everything. I can't tell you the planning, the amount of time. And the question was asked, how many people do you want? How many young people do you want to take part in this study? So we said, as many as you can. And he said, what, dozens? Hundreds? Because in a big local authority, you've got hundreds of kids that are involved in child protection. I said, yes, we'll take hundreds. And that is often the optimistic and ambitious way that one starts a study. The reality was that after 18 months, we had 11 participants in the study. And this paper that got published, that I'm going to be talking about, or that I'm talking about, is based on only 11. And that's a separate thing in itself, and we'll come on to that. What do you do with a consultation that's supposed to represent an entire population, a subsection of children, but you only have a small number of participants? Do you take the consultation and chuck it in the bin and say, well, you know, it's basically useless with too few people? Or do you take the view, as we did, if 11 young people have had the courage and the sensitivity to stand up and tell the story, then we have to listen to that. As to the generalizability of it, well, we've had huge controversy over this. But we ended up with 11 people, 11 young people, and I'll now explain why. Why that happened in where we should have had hundreds. Okay, well, what were we trying to look at? Well, what we were saying, we wanted to look at the views and experiences of 11, wasn't what we wanted to look at, of 11, that's what we ended up. But we looked at 11 young people who had been subject to a child protection investigation in the previous 18 months. So that was quite a period going back, and we felt that, well, that's legitimate, 18 months. They won't have forgotten it, because it's very vivid in their life. And we should, it shouldn't be too raw for them. We were very clear that, and this is another thing when you're consulting in this area, we were very clear that we would not be discussing the events that led up to the child protection investigation. We were not going to discuss the physical or sexual abuse or the neglect or the emotional abuse. That was not the nature of our discussion with the participants. And this was made clear in all our literature, and we did so many briefings with social work, but absolutely 100%, we start our discussion when the investigation began. In other words, we would start our discussion with the young person when the knock on the door arrived and two strangers appeared to say, we're here because there's a problem. That was where we would start. And it was very important that we set that out, because we would, to start digging into the back, doing the backstory of it, would be potentially horrendous. So that was our aim. The truth is that in reality, that was impossible to achieve. And this became very problematical, because the kids wanted to talk about what had happened. They weren't really interested just in meeting my particular research requirements. They had feelings of their own, and they told their stories, and it became very, very complicated ethically. And one incident we had, which was extremely upsetting. I remember I interviewed all the kids myself, because I felt it was important to do that. But I always had the researcher with me. But in one particular interview, the girl, I should have said the kids were between 12 and 16, 12 and 16 plus. There were two groups. Anyway, we'll come back to that. One of the girls, she was about 16, and I told her, and anyway, she started to talk about the abuse, and she got very, very upset. And I said, well, you know, I'm used to dealing with kids. I've been working in the psychologist for 30 odd years. And I tried to steer her away and get back on track of what we were trying to look at. But she wanted to talk about the story, and she became very upset. And it was getting out of hand. And I told her that we'd have to stop the interview because it wasn't good for her. I'll come back to the ethical considerations we had, but this is just to illustrate. Anyway, she wouldn't hear of it, and she wanted to continue. So she continued with her story. Now, my research assistant, she's been with me for about a year, and I can't say I'm the easiest person to work with, but my research assistant started to cry because the story was so upsetting. And sometimes, you know, you can sit and be a professional, but behind the mask, you're a human being. And the story was so harrowing, she started to cry. So I stood up and I said to the girl, that's it. We call a halt at this point. I'm not allowing this to continue because it's upsetting, not my research assistant, but it's upsetting the girl. It was so bad. And she leaned across the table. I kid you not. She leaned across the table, a table this size, and she took my hands and she begged me, let me continue. Let me continue. Just like that. So, of course, I did. But this is what happens when you start consulting with children. You can have your own idea in your head, but you do not know what path you're walking in their mind, and you don't know what you're going to stir up. And there were of the 11 interviews, three or four, that was the most harrowing, but three or four were just breathtaking in terms of the story. So all I'm pointing out here is you have a wonderful plan of consultation. It's all very neat and tidy, but you need to keep a steady nerve and know what you're doing. Now, essentially, what we were doing were individual semi-structured interviews. We had half a dozen questions, and we were going to ask these questions and see what happened. And the interviews generally took about half an hour. It was in a very comfortable room, a table this size. We had, every time we consult with kids, you know, we've got sweets, we've got drinks and fruit, all very nice, all very relaxed. And my research assistant was beside me, and we recorded it, and she also took notes and so on. So that was the kind of format of it. Now, before we started, and I'd say again, for consulting with children, as psychologists, we have very strict ethical guidelines, but any professional group has. And you have to work out for yourself how you would approach such a study. The first concern when you're consulting with kids on a very sensitive topic like this, because you could be talking with a child who's been raped by her father all her life, you know, and you're asking her, sorry, could you just tell me your story just in half an hour, neat and tidy and have no feelings? So you've got, is the participant welfare? How do you safeguard the interests of the child that you're consulting with? And these we can all discuss in great detail, more than you want. I'll tell you that we have a very strong ethics committee in Renfrewshire, a research ethics committee in the psychological service. But this was so complicated, we brought in an outside specialist, an emeritus professor of psychology, to sit on our ethics committee because it was so potentially hazardous. And in hindsight, I'm delighted we did that because of the intensity of it. So you have to weigh up. How are you going to safeguard? What happens if a child comes away from your consultation and they go home and, God forbid, they take a bottle of pills? Because you stirred the pot. This whatever was in their lives was a year ago, and they've built the barrier over it, they've healed, and you come in, you start mixing around, and they fall apart. You have to think of the disaster scenario. So we built in safeguards in terms of follow-up contact, availability of psychologists, and working with social workers and so on, such that if the child did have any negative reaction, we could at least provide the support for it. I'd have to say, though, we had not one, despite some of the horrors of the interview themselves, we had not one request for help. And I was delighted at that. There's the family contact. You have to weigh up. That's the other thing. When you're consulting with children and young people, at what stage do you seek the parental permission? Now, I'm going to come back to this one because it's very tricky, but at what stage do you do it? Do you do it when the child's 14? Do you do it when they're 12? When they're 17? And if you are, supposing it's a family that have finally got over all this, they've had a year's help from social work, psychologists, they're really on the way, and you we come along as researchers and say, like, you know how you're all well just now. Well, you, a year ago, you were in a hell of a mess, and we'd like to talk about that. You could end up tearing the family apart, reminding them of something that they've spent a year trying to put behind them and build. You have to think of that as well. And what we did for that was we relied very heavily on the social workers who, and psychologists who knew the... Phil, you have a seat, it's fine. We relied heavily on the social workers to guide us in that. And we'll come on now to recruitment. Now, recruitment to a study like this, when you're doing a consultation, and it's very temperamental, is extremely... you have to be very careful how we did it, but this is problems as well, and I'll come on to that in a moment. We relied totally on the social work department to do it for us. It would be unacceptable for... How we did it was this. We would tell the social worker, we spoke to all the individual social workers, this is what we're trying to do. Do you have any kids that would fit into this category? And children and families who you think would be robust enough to take part in such a consultation process about such a sensitive issue. And of course, that's when the attrition rate becomes high, because many of the children and young people who have been through this process, who would have fitted into our criteria, were not ready emotionally to start talking about the process. And therefore, we relied heavily on the social workers to deal with that. It's very important that the children and young people taking part in such a consultation should have informed consent. They should know exactly. And we prepared information sheets and so on and so forth, all child-friendly. Remember, we had a whole system. We've been doing this work for 10 years, so we've got a whole system of how we produce such information for children and families. It was absolutely imperative that the child should be giving informed consent, that they should say yes and they should know what they're saying yes to. I mean, so many consultations you see where children, particularly younger ones, are kind of told by people, professionals, you know, you should take part in this study. But the question is, does the child really make informed consent? And that's something we can talk about. Now, what were the other issues that came? Well, I put it as methodological challenges. You have to weigh up when you're consulting with children on an issue like this, where you know that the very discussion of this matter, although it's in the long-term interest to improve the system, to improve the child protection system, you know that it could be damaging to the child. But you also have to weigh that against the child's right to tell the story. And you have to balance that carefully. Are you going to take a sort of benign, patronising view? Well, the child's too damaged to tell the story, so we'll protect them and we won't let them take part. In which case, you're taking a child who's already marginalised by being part of an abused group, already marginalised, and you're marginalising them further by not letting them take part. And this is, there's no sort of clear line in this, but it's very, very important. If you decide that they're not right for it, are you doing them a disservice? So rights versus welfare is very important. What do you do in the situation where a child, sorry, I've stayed out the microphone, where a parent says of a 14-year-old, a parent who abused the child, says, I'm not letting my child take part in this study. I'm not letting them give their views. Is that fair? How do you balance that up? So the child is, in effect, abused a second time. Now, it might not be because I'm not saying the parent who committed the abuse. Let's say it was neglect. The parent went through a phase. They were depressed, disoriented, I'm not saying that's not abuse, but that it wasn't direct, deliberate malevolence. See, the parent went through a period of mental disruption. They lost the place, the kids were neglected, but now they're all back. So the parent wasn't malicious to the child. They just couldn't cope because of their own mental health problems. So let's take that parent. But suppose that parent says, no, I don't want my child to take part. I just don't like the study. But the child says, I want to take part. What are you going to do? Now, we had bitter discussions about this because such a distinction did arise in a couple of instances. And whose rights are more important, the child or the parent? And do you balance them up that way? I don't know. There's the issue of gatekeeping as well. I told you that all the social workers were the recruiting officers for our study. But there's huge pressure on them. You see, they know we want the study done. And believe me, when me and my team, when I was in that position, we delivered. And we were on the phone every day, pushing, provoking, challenging. We need more people, we need more people. So you've got us pressurising the social workers to deliver, but the social workers, we're also saying, but take your time in how you deliver, make a sensitive choice. And so you can see the tension the social workers face in trying to please basically their colleagues and their employer, but safeguarding the rights of the child. And the question is, how do we know anyway that the social workers made the right judgments? What about all the kids who were desperate to tell the story, but they were deemed by a third party to be not suitable to take part in the consultation? What impact does that have on them? Perhaps that's more damaging than if they had taken part. The other methodological problem, and this is just something you will find when you're doing consultation, that everyone's got lists of clients, they've got their databases, particularly social work department. I'm not being critical here, but the minute you start to drill down, you read the stats, I don't know, Aberdeen, well, I don't know why I'm saying Aberdeen, City, we'll just call it City, has 300 children on their child abuse register. Let's say 300. I guarantee you that the minute you start to explore that statistic, you find that it is way out. First of all, it was based 3 years ago. Half the kids have moved out of the area. You can't track half of them down. The addresses are wrong. The dates of birth are wrong. The minute you drill down, I can see some of you laughing, so you know the experience. The minute you drill down, God, it's like trying to nail a jelly to the ceiling. Believe me, it all falls apart. And suddenly, you start to get the statistics say that, but you know, we're going through our records, and you start to backtrack, and suddenly your whole study is beginning to fall away from you. So if you add in that, plus the ethical considerations, plus this one and that one, now you know why we ended up with 11. I'll tell you that we got 11 was a bloody miracle. I'll tell you. Anyway, that these are the issues when you're doing consultation. But let's now come down to, well, this shows the age. Basically, 6 were between 12 and 15, and 5 were between 16 and 17. I can tell you that for the 16 and 17-year-olds, I didn't ask parental permission. That's considered, and I think most people agree with that. With the 12 to 15-year-olds, I didn't want to, but I did. That was part of my ethics committee requirement. I didn't want to, for reasons I've said, but I did. So, a total of 11. Right. So, I'll just go through the results. I mean, they're all in the report, but I'll just do it. I've got about another 5, 10 minutes before I'll stop. These were the 6 questions we asked them. What did you expect to happen? By and large, they hadn't a clue. They had not a scooby. Now, remember, we're talking now the knock on the door. Just at the knock on the door, and two people come in and say, we're here, we're social workers, or we're police. And that's what we're looking at, these first few hours. That's what this question is about. Now, basically, none of them knew what it was about. And it's very interesting because, you know, we've got all these child line, all the child protection information plastered everywhere in schools, doctors' surgeries, goodness knows where. It's all not. If they did know about it, the fear took over immediately and they forgot about it. They had not a clue. And the whole thing came as a complete surprise and shock. The only one that didn't, there was one girl, she had called the investigation herself. So she had been expecting it. But by and large, the concept of what child protection was at that specific point, they really hadn't got a clue, which is quite worrying, given all the sort of education that we put in for children about that. What happened when the investigation began? Very confusing. Big thing that came out, big common fear. I'm not saying it's quite universal, for reasons I'll explain in a minute, but the thought that we heard echoed by virtually all the kids was the fear of being removed from the family. And it's very interesting, because I know that in some of the instances, the children were at the hard end of sexual abuse from a family member, but they were terrified that they would be taken away. And the participant who actually called the investigation herself and initiated the inquiry, also the same. She was afraid that it would be the breakup of the family. So it's very interesting that was a common fear. Now, it's not surprising, but it's something I'm going to come back to, because I think when we're working with children like in that situation, we have to acknowledge that. For many of them, it was just a whole days. It was a blur. They didn't feel they were participating. They didn't feel they knew what was going on. It was very much, there's something going on in that room over there, and I'm sitting in here, and I just don't know what's happening. They didn't feel informed, and they didn't feel part of it. But of those kids who did feel part of it, they did feel more positive about the process. And I think that's very important. But it shouldn't be a surprise to us, where children are truly treated and consulted along the way during a child protection investigation, and they feel, they're less negative about it. How much did they actually understand? About half the kids felt they hadn't a clue. What's interesting is that children were generally always, and you don't need me to tell you this, of course they are told what's going to happen. I mean, two social workers or a social worker or a policeman do not turn up at the door, interview a child and say nothing about anything. That just doesn't happen. Of course they were told. But that didn't mean the kids heard it. And this is an important point, that we can present information to children and young people, but that doesn't mean that they absorb it or they take it in. And one of the recommendations we made touches on that point. So we cannot simply say, well, I told them exactly what was going to happen, so it's all fine, I've ticked that box and everything's cool. The child at that point, particularly in the first few hours, and the first few hours is when information is generally passed over to the child, these first few hours, the child's mostly, I would say, emotionally vulnerable, not an emotional wreck, but certainly not in a state to be able to focus and hear everything and absorb it. Right, how helpful did you find the child protection process? Well, it's interesting, because question 5 is a follow-up for that. They just felt it wasn't particularly helpful. The process wasn't helpful. There was a lack of follow-up, there was a lack of information, they weren't represented. I think it's disappointing, but it's not a surprise that they felt that. They just didn't feel connected enough with the process, so it didn't really help. But very interesting, when we asked about the support itself, we're now well down the line. We're past the first two-hour stage, we're past the six-month stage, we're about 9 months to a year after the investigation. The kids hated the investigation. What did they think of the outcome? Virtually all loved it. Very interesting. And how it just became so routine that this would be the reply. It was wonderful. They'd sit going how awful it was. They didn't listen. I was afraid. I was petrified. In other words, I suppose it's the reverse of the operation was a success, but the patient died. The operation was not a success, but the patient lived. Basically, the professionals had got it right. And the kids felt that. The children and young people felt it. The outcome was good, but the pain to get that outcome was more than the children at the time would have been prepared to pay. But the professionals got it right in the end most times. I think that was very, very reassuring. That's a very important result to take away from. How could the child protection process... Well, basically, it was what could we do differently to make it... This, now, there's very interesting, because at this point, you're saying to the child, I can do nothing to help you and the experience you had. And this is what we do in consultations, in effect, but this was the way it's... We're basically saying to the child, you've been through hell, and I cannot help you with that. But I want you to go one more stage, not just having talked about what happened and relived it for me. I want you to give me advice that will help the ones coming after you. But I cannot help you personally. That's a lot to ask of a 12-year-old, to think pro-socially about the ones who are coming after them. But they all did. It was remarkable. They all did. And they all had bloody good suggestions, I'll tell you. And these suggestions I'll come on to in a moment. But isn't it amazing that children who have suffered so much and who can gain nothing by this study would then really come up with good suggestions as to what could be done to improve. Anyway, here's the sort of bread and butter of the suggestions. And these became our recommendations for our local authority to take. Number one, they should be given more information at the start of the process. It should not be a surprise to the professionals that the child needs to be told what's happening. They're not going to be able to listen. So there has to be a combination of talking to the young person, handing them child-friendly information, such that they can hang on to it. Like, I came here today, I walked in, the first thing is I'm giving an information pack. Right? I don't look at it because I've got other things in my mind just now, like how's the talk going to go, is anyone going to be upset, and so on and so on. But on the way back, I'll read that when I've time. And I'll go over it, and I'll learn more about this organisation and so on. Young people are no different. So we need to think about information. I think it's important that we should acknowledge the child's fear of separation, and that we should say at the start, look, I guess that what's going through your head just now is you're afraid that we're going to break the family up, or we're going to take your dad out of the family home or whatever. At least acknowledge it. Now, you can't prejudge the outcome and say, don't worry, that's not going to happen, because you don't know what's going to happen. But I think to acknowledge the child's fear and say, look, I understand, and you know, every person that sits in the chair that you're sitting feels the exact same. But I can help you with it, and I can talk to you about it, but I know that's what's going on in your head. I think that would be helpful. I'm speaking now from the psychological perspective. I think also it's very important to recognise that the child protection investigation is a process. It's not an event. And therefore, perhaps 3 months down the line, 6 months down the line, the information that you gave to the young person at the start of the process, you repeat. Because you can be sure they've already lost the booklet, the dog ate it, they can't remember what you said. So give them the information again during the investigation, such that it keeps it fresh in the mind. I think obviously we need to ensure the child is genuinely involved and listened to in the process, and not just tokenism. Yeah, come into the room, there's 10 of us. What do you want to happen, Jimmy? And Jimmy just sits there, and he didn't even hear the question. He's just like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And is my fly undone? Have I dribbled down? You know, so do it properly. That's very important. Kids talked a lot about action plans. There was always plans of action, but they never actually knew if the plans had been carried out or not. And I think it would be very helpful to formalise that, to say, well, look, we sat here in January and we said 3 things would happen. The house would be tidier, you'd get a visit and a chat with your social worker half an hour every 2 weeks, and so on. It's 3 months on. Yes, we've done number one. We've done number two. We're still working on number three. It makes the process very real for the child. And we can't assume. I think the problem is that we assume that what's going on in our head is going on in the child's head. So we need to clarify, spell it out. Reports. Children are always waiting. Right, this was a general thing that came out. Right, the investigation's over, it's all been resolved, and we go back to our offices and we go on with the next case and we'll review it in 6 months or whatever the review is. And the child's sitting there wondering, what is happening? When am I seeing them again? Is there going to be another knock on the door? You're talking of an anxious and a vulnerable young person. So I think making regular contact with the child and just giving a progress report. This is where we're at just now. You're doing well, you're not doing well, your mum's doing well, she's not doing well. Something just to keep the child engaged and knowing where they're at. Now, the last thing was that an incredibly high number of, there's only 11, but a significant percentage, had no idea whether or not they were on the child protection register. Now, that's simply inexcusable. It was the repetitiveness of this comment. They hadn't a clue. That's just poor professional practice. If it's done to protect the child, I can't think why. It's simply inexcusable. It's their lives, and they need to know what's happening. So these became our recommendations, right? I've gone over my time by 2 minutes. These became our recommendations to the local authority. And this comes back to when you consult with children and young people. You have an obligation not just to write the paper, close it, hand over and say, well, that's it, I've done my work. What's next? What is the authority going to do about it? Because this, whichever way you look at it, this is an action plan for change to make the process better. And as these 11 children had, as I said, stepped up to the plate and told this story, I was very committed, me and my team were very committed, we had said to them that they would make a difference, that we would implement it. So we had a series of presentations, a bit like this, to the police, the fire, social workers, most heated. I'm not saying people were throwing things at me, but I'd say a playing card away from it. This is ridiculous. It's only 11 people. How can you make any statement like this? You're asking us to turn the whole system around for that. Well, there isn't a great answer to that. You see, what can you say? The Renfrewshire had, let's say, hundreds of kids that could have taken part, but well, so I just kept saying, if you think you can reject these 11 children's stories, then go ahead and do it. If you can sleep well at night as a professional, then reject 11 stories. Reject what they've said. But for those of us who are more sensible than that, we're going to try and take it on board. Anyway, the long and the short is most of these recommendations have been implemented. And I think that was very important because, now I'm not saying that they were implemented because the HMIE were coming to inspect, although that did help. Nothing wrong with having the odds stacked in your favour. But this was one of the reasons why Renfrewshire got an excellent child protection report. I'm not saying just on the basis of this, but this was one of it. Because they had listened and they had made an effort to take. Now, one of the things in consultation, just to finish, is supposing you ask a group of kids, what will make school life better for you? And they say, well, if I can smoke dope, if we can have sex, and free bevy, right? You've asked them and they've told you. So what do you do? Are you going to have to, is the only way forward to say, right, we've listened, this is what you're getting? No, of course not. What we have to work out in our heads is the difference between consulting, listening, and how we use that consultation. Now, in this instance, I felt consulting with children, everything they said was rational and made sense. There's nothing there that anyone that I've spoken to sort of would say, gosh, that's ridiculous, that's offensive. The acknowledging the fear of separation, that didn't come from the young people. That was my interpretation. But you have to weigh up what it means when you listen to children. Does it mean you do everything they say? And what if you don't do everything they say? And this is where people get very confused with, and I've seen it happen. And you have to work that out. Anyway, that's it. I have overstepped my mark by 5 minutes. We'll call it a halt at that, and you've all been very well behaved, thank you. But if you're burning with rage or burning with optimism, whatever, any question at all, while still being polite to one another, of course, any question, comment is most welcome. I mean that genuinely. Thank you.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.